Okay, welcome back. Thank you for being here, and I hope people are holding up all right during the current global social disorder challenge, harsh testing, death-rebirth process. Today, we're going to conclude the reading of the book Nityananda in Divine Presence, the final chapter called Remembering the Master, Part 2. This is Class 14 of the Nityananda series, and it will continue, meaning I will be reading from the next book, Nityananda Sky of the Heart, Jewels of Wisdom, which I don't have as a PDF, so I'll read with the book in my hand starting next week, I think. Today, the final chapter is a sort of a little sad to me, or such I felt, where you see Captain Hattengi relating his story of his relationship with Nityananda at the end game, where in the beginning, or in the 20s, 30s it seemed, the whole situation was so small. There were not thousands of devotees coming asking for blessings and this and that, that Captain Hattengi could sit with Nityananda in Guruvan or in Kanangad area and just have quiet, intimate time together, sitting. I mean, the darshan of sitting together in silence. Beautiful, beautiful. And that was really not available at the end. And Nityananda's life, he basically gave himself to humanity, in a sense, where he settled in one place and just kept doing his thing, and more people kept coming, and they had to keep building and accommodating the increasing number, and everything that was given was put right back out to the community for feeding programs for children and sannyasis and a hospital and a lodging and developing the infrastructure of that area where he had done the same in the south as well. And so from Ganesh Puri to Kailash at the end, as it had been done from Kanangad or Guruvan area in the south before that, he's just flowing along and doing his danda, and more people are coming, and inevitably the preciousness of how things were early on was unavailable at the end. And so Remembering the Master, Part 2, is the last chapter in the book Nityananda in Divine Presence, which again is compiled by this Captain Hattengi, and these are his final recollections. And I will read this chapter today and also bring in an interesting quote from another teacher that I never really was close to, but I had a close friend who loved him, Meher Baba. He was the one who said, don't worry, be happy. But I think he was a little deeper than that. Talking about Antaryani, and the guru like the sun and the rays of the sun and the world that gets illuminated by the sun and its sunbeams. Very interesting passage, the second link I sent. So let me read the final chapter of Nityananda in Divine Presence and bring some other references in and prepare for the next section or the next book next time. So, final chapter, Remembering the Master, Part 2, from Captain Hattengi. On a dark night in June 1945, I was at my usual place by the door to the room nearest the baths. Oddly, Nityananda was sitting behind me some 12 feet away. We were both both facing south and peering into the darkness, when suddenly he shouted in Konkani, "Who's there?" I had to strain my eyes to see a person slowly moving toward us. "It is I," the man replied. Another shout erupted behind me, meaning Nityananda. "Who?" demanded the master. This time the man said, Satyanarayana Prasad. Prasad is an offering, and Satyanarayana, I don't know. Satya is correct. Satyanarayana Prasad. The master shouted back, "Prasad for whom?" Repeating this a second time, he added, "Is anything known about this place?" Meaning himself. What's that? Well, somebody had come there making some kind of offering, or attempting to, and Nityananda challenged him, but it was all telepathic in terms of Nityananda knowing where the guy's coming from and addressing his intention without dialogue associated with the offering of prasad. And the next paragraph goes on. I had considered Nityananda to be an incarnate personality, also the word antaryani, since I first received his darshan, meaning a completely enlightened being from birth. This incident only strengthened my belief, and I wondered why he seemed angry. Turning to look at him, I saw him in a posture radiating such power that I quickly averted my eyes. With great kindness, he said to me, prasad means something received with God presenting himself fully satisfied in the chosen form and bestowing the gift. You may have it now. By offering it to me, I knew the prasad had been consecrated, meaning the food or the material. Pointing to the stranger, he then added, that man did not come for prasad, but for sankalpa. A sankalpa is a vow taken to perform some action if a prayer is answered, a practice that the master generally discouraged. As the man began telling his story, my guru Nityananda admonished him and ordered him to return to the ashram from which he had come. And so, what is that all about? It took me a little time to try to figure this out. The man is coming with an offering so that his request or prayer is answered. Came to Nityananda agreeing to vow, within a vow in mind to be taken if the prayer that he had been offering, he was about to bring to Nityananda, the prayer to ask something, would be answered by Nityananda. That Nityananda discouraged the practice is also important. A lot of people actually, not a lot, obviously, but in Buddhist and Hindu communities over the centuries, it is a practice that is sometimes taken, give me this and I promise you that. If I get this, I'll do that. And Nityananda said, this is Sankalpa, and why did Nityananda discourage it? Probably because, as far as I can see, it gets one into multi-incarnational dynamics that one is not unaware of. Making a certain kind of vow in a metaphysical spiritual setting, demanding, requesting the answering of a prayer or the fulfillment of a wish from a teacher or through a magical metaphysical process binds one in ways one doesn't understand. Self-binding by unwise sankalpa, vowing, vow making upon fulfillment of a wish or a prayer. That's just one part of it, but I think that people can get into trouble when they're signing up for obligation that they don't understand. So this man perhaps came that way then, Nityananda knowing that without having to talk to him, of course, also acknowledged that there was an offering to him called Prasad being given in the vow making, and this posture radiating such power is a kind of fierceness. Why so fierce? Probably because there were metaphysical forces in play that he had to neutralize, because the guy came from another ashram. He was ordered back to an ashram from which he had come, meaning he came from some other ashram, perhaps even with the teacher there, or some portion of the organization there, deciding upon the plan to go to Nityananda to offer prasad in support of a sankalpa, meaning a promise and a vow to do something in exchange for a answering of the prayer or a granting of his wish. And so there's lots of spiritual trouble that can come from getting involved in things you don't understand. So that's the first story there. But again, it just shows not only Nityananda's apparent omniscience, knowing the mind, the background of this, of the person approaching him without even talking to him, but also the metaphysics that are involved in the common vowing procedures that were going on there, and the need to neutralize it by a certain kind of fierce forcefulness. Anyway, interesting, strange story there. Going on, several months passed until one evening the master said, quote, "Mothers are more important. They know what fathers only think to be so." Meaning, they are more important, and they know that which fathers think they know, but don't really know. The mothers know, the fathers only think they know. "It is the mother who points out the father, brothers, and sisters to the child. This the child believes without question. The mother is to the child what the guru is to the disciple. The guru reveals God to the disciple and enables the disciple to experience his presence." Now, I want to pull right in here a QA from Mayor Baba. The page is the avatarmeher.org. Baba, meaning Mayor Baba, or Father, Baba's response to questions regarding the union and the circle, whatever that is. But talking about the relationship between guru and disciple, and that's not devotee, that's disciple. Different. This is not Buddhism. This is Hinduism. But their goal is the same. And so let's take universal truth wherever we find it. Question to Meher Baba. "Then if this prize," meaning, I think, attainment, complete and perfect enlightenment, you know, moksha, mukti, moksha, complete, perfect liberation, freedom. "Then if this prize is sure of attainment for everyone, why strive for it? It will come of itself." This is a question that is commonly asked from the perspective, in response to the perspective or the truth that all souls will return to source someday. Yes, indeed. And it's all done by God anyway. So, if the prize is sure of attainment for everyone, why strive for it? It will come of itself. Mayor Baba answered, "Your striving and struggle are what bring you nearer and nearer to the goal of truth. Even though you fail 99 times, if at last the 100th effort brings to you the realized Jnani Guru, wisdom guru, all your labor is amply repaid." Meaning the 100th time, even if you failed 99. "For from that moment when you find the guru, you will be pushed continuously towards the goal of truth through your guru's secret working and hidden powers. Hence it is said, strive on and on. Take as an analogy these sun rays falling in the center of the makan." And that was a structure, makan e kas, staff quarters of the main mandali. Mandali is from mandala. It's, I think, just the Hindu term for a religious building structure, physical structure for residence or ritual. So the sun rays falling in the center of the building where he was giving that talk, perhaps, which have penetrated through some opening in the wall, the sun rays, compared to the greater space of the makan, which still lies in darkness, that portion illuminated by the light of the rays is small, and the rays themselves are few. So you've got the makan, the sun rays, and then the portion of the structure illuminated by those rays, right? Such is the condition of the people in this universe. Actually, it's 3D humanity. The huge mass of humanity remains in the dark, ignorant of any real knowledge. Only a few can be counted among the knowers of inner knowledge, Antaryami. That's another translation of Antaryami. So, the huge mass of humanity remains in the dark, ignorant of any real knowledge. Then, only a few can be counted among the knowers of inner knowledge, Antaryami, having gleaned light from a realized person. These who possess inner knowledge can be compared to the rays just mentioned, few in number, but even so, rays merely, and not the sun itself, which remains far, far above this earthly domain and altogether out of reach. Real knowledge means journeying towards and becoming one with the sun. From there, having attained that, one throws light. By comparison, to be like a sun ray is nothing. They are only rays, after all. This was a lecture from 1926. Hey, hey, it's ageless wisdom. Time means nothing. So there's the sun. There's the sun rays, or beams. There are those that are touched by the rays of the sun. And then there's that which is not touched by the rays of the sun. So, like the structure of the building, a huge mass of humanity, like most of the building, in that case of sitting in the building where there was a light streaming through some of the windows, most of the building, most of humanity remains in the dark. Yeah, they're 3D repeating, very much so, and decent. You know, their heart chakra activated somewhat, but insufficient for a 4D positive graduation, right? They're co-creating catalyst, co-programming catalyst before birth with higher self. Yeah, could be, seems to be what Ra said. That's more than half, but not harvestable or meek enough to inherit the earth, not positively oriented or committed to truth and goodness enough. Then you have those that are have some degree of knowing inner knowledge, having gleaned light from a realized person, or been touched by the rays of the sun. The rays of the sun could be seen as a guru, the sun could be seen as a guru, but actually the sun is the logos, or the sun is a physical manifestation of the logos, just as the solar system is too, but perhaps it's a more holistic or a more fitting, accurate manifestation. Its nature is closer to the nature of the logos than a planet. So a star system with planets and a sun, that whole thing is a physical representation, physical manifestation, the 3D form, one of the 3D forms of the logos. A logos that may manifest multiple solar systems. And so the sun, in a sense, is not really more of the logos than a planet, but its nature giving light and heat and life. It's light giving life, or it's life giving light, actually. Its life manifests light in a way of greater potency than the physical earth, than the planets of a solar system, is therefore a closer symbolic representation or manifestation of the of its author, of God or the Logos. So, I would say the Logos is like the sun, and the great teachers are like the sun beams, and even great teaching is like the rays of sun. And then those few here who are touched by it, live more fully in the light of love, truth, and that comes through the teaching and the teacher. And it's interesting, I don't know Meher Baba's work much at all, but he talks about the goal of truth. The goal of truth. The goal of truth, I think, means that liberation, we talk about the goal as liberation. The goal being what? Freedom from the octave, okay. Complete and perfect enlightenment, yeah. The perfection of the seven rays, seven chakras, yeah. Okay. Union of Paramatma, of Jivatman and Paramatman, meaning higher self, returns to the Logos. Higher self as a sub-sub-Logos goes back to the solar, which is a sub-Logos. Okay? Logoic reunification. Logoic reunification. Reunification of the spark of the Logos as higher self, as the, very much like the significator, actually, in the series of seven in the tarot. The higher self as a sub-sub-Logos returns to the solar Logos and is free of the need to reincarnate in the octave. That's a goal that is of liberation, ending of desire, ending of craving, ending of rebirth, ending of maya or avidya, ignorance. That is also a goal called truth. It's the truth of full manifestation of true nature. One's own true nature is the true nature of the one. It's not a personal possession, so it's not my true nature, it's the true nature. It's transpersonal, impersonal, prepersonal, non-personal. It's the source, it's return to the source of light. Return to the nature, to the source of light whose nature is life, which is of the three primary qualities, like the first three laws of free will, love, and light. So return to source is return to true nature, which is the goal of evolution, which is a final a return to reality, and therefore could be called a goal of truth, I'd say. Now, going on, Captain Hatengi continues. Sometimes he, Nityananda, denied responsibility for his actions, even benevolent ones. One morning in 1946, so this is 15 years before he passed, is not the last days at all, but getting there. One morning in 1946, as we sat in our usual places, a man approached. Nityananda rose, took a stick from the roof, struck him four or five times, replaced the stick, and sat down again. The man left without uttering a sound. Seeing my confusion, the master said, "This one has not beaten him. He came to get beaten." And it is indeed true that many people believed such beatings to be blessings that would ward off trouble. Personally, I was beaten by Edo Roshi in Dokusan. It was not Dokusan, it was, maybe call it Dokusan, in the Sesshin private meeting with the Roshi during one of the 7-day retreats or meditation intensives at Daibosatsu Zendo in, I don't know what, 81, 82. And it was great. I mean, he just, you know, just with the keisaku stick on the shoulder blade, on the muscles, not the bone. And it was just perfect. It was great. I really liked it. It was not sadistic at all. It was really helped to beat out the pain and blockage in me. And he asked, "What is mu?" And I demonstrated my understanding of mu, and was well rewarded by multiple beatings with the keisaku on the shoulder. And it was great. I felt really happy afterwards. And he said something like, Only the swift horse gets the stick, and that's the way it goes. So there is some, at the right time, when one is deep in certain kind of dukkha, path dukkha, that kind of a beating is very helpful. Going on, Hatengi explains, "This reminds me of a story about the great Vyasa, author of the Vedas, the 18 Puranas, and the Mahabharata, with its beloved Bhagavad Gita. It is in his honor, Vyasa, that we celebrate Guru Purnima every July in India. As he, Vyasa, sat one evening on the banks of the river Jumna, some milkmaids carrying pots of curds approached, desiring to cross over. Because it was dusk and the river was high, they asked the sage to use his good offices to make the river open a path for them. Vyasa asked them for something to eat, partook of the offered curds and whey, right? This is a milk, like paneer, and then addressed the river, "If I have eaten nothing, make a way for these milkmaids." The river complied at once and made an opening. Because Vyasa always identified with the absolute Atman and not with his physical body, his true form, meaning he, had not eaten. Nityananda was often described in the same way. My visits to Ganesh Puri, and here's where you can see how all good things come to an end. My visits to Ganesh Puri were infrequent between 1948 and 1954, estranging me from a new generation of devotees. Then, restationed in Bombay from 1955 to 1957, I often felt lost during my monthly visits. In addition, my few overnights were spent in the big hall, since the one flanking Nityananda's room were no longer used by visitors, two of them. One was now a kitchen, while the other was kept closed and used for storage. One rainy September night, rather than stay in the big hall, I made up my mind to sit outside the kitchen near the master, who sat there on a bench. At 7 o'clock, he called to a devotee whom I did not know, asking him to open the closed room for me. I spent the night there, surrounded by gifts and other offerings to Nityananda, the storage room. I departed early the next day, later learning that Nityananda departed the same morning for a new ashram in Kailas. So things are changing, and he doesn't have time with Nityananda anymore. After 1957, closer to the end, I only visited Ganesh Puri once or twice a year. Because of what I had understood him to mean years earlier, I always kept to myself, courteous but not overly friendly with other devotees. When Nityananda moved his living quarters to the new ashram in Kailas, specific hours were set for darshan. The old ashram central hall was now usually empty, because most devotees gathered in the west hall. On my sporadic visits, I usually occupied a corner of the old hall near the bench where the master used to sit. My habit was to arrive in the early afternoon and leave by 7 the next morning. However, to catch even a glimpse of Nityananda meant knocking hourly at the Kailas doors until they were opened at 5 o'clock or later. Sometimes special arrangements were made for devotees who had traveled great distances, but a virtual stranger to the new ashram's attendants, I was overlooked. Frustrated, I wondered why the master failed to make special arrangements for me. Finally, I saw him one evening. He said to me, "Where do you stay these days?" Since he had always seemed to know what I was doing, even when stationed to remote areas, I was irked at the question. Petulantly, I replied, "Where else? There," meaning in the big hall. With an admonishing tone, he used his index finger to point to the place I had occupied in the old ashram and said, "Only there is good." I confess that his response was unclear to me at the time. I was too busy thinking that if this were so, why was he in Kailas? Meaning, Nityananda was pointing to the place in the old ashram, but he's in the new ashram called Kailas, which is also in the Ganesh Puri area. It's just not that far. It's just a different building, I think. Why is he saying I should be over there when he's over here and he doesn't seem to care about me? He's maybe thinking. But I kept quiet. Only when he left his physical body and his remains were interred near that very spot did I understand. And so it's almost like Nityananda let his life be directed to some degree by the needs of the throng around him. And even while the old ashram where he pointed and said, "Only there is good," is perhaps where he personally would have preferred to be, where Captain Hatengi with him had been before, where he had been before. He still let them build a new structure called Kailash with all these new devotees and attendants that didn't have any connection to Captain Hatengi and were sort of running the situation around him. I think he might have regretted that. And so after he left, he may have regretted that or had a second thought that, you know, there are many ways to play a human life, and there's a value to surrendering to the needs of the many, and there's a value to leaving them away, leaving them alone, and going off to one's own life. And this is relevant to a passage in the previous chapter, Remembering the Master, Part 1, where in the third paragraph it's written, "On one visit, a young man ran up to me outside the ashram and asked if he could come. Saying that I thought everyone was welcome, I brought him along. Nityananda was away, but we soon saw him approaching from the direction of the river." He probably had deposited his body under the water to travel outside and come back to it later. "He seemed to be shouting at the stranger by my side. Entering the ashram, the master shouted again, asking the startled man who had brought him, and then told him to leave." Meaning Captain Hatengi had brought him, but Nityananda shouts at him and tells him to leave. "Turning to me, he," Nityananda said, "never put yourself out to anyone here. People come with different predilections, vasanas, and it's not for you to interfere." End quote. "My subsequent strict compliance with this directive brought me problems later on, but no matter. I now understood the necessity of keeping to myself and not becoming distracted from my spiritual practice." This is the difference between seeking to learn and grow and seeking to be of service. They're not the same. They work together. They don't have to be together, however. Meaning, Nityananda's not, he's not saying, spread the message and bring the masses in. Everyone you can find, tell them the good news and bring them in to the church. I've got something wonderful here and I just want the whole world to see. Nothing like that at all. He's really saying you should know what's yours to do and what's not yours to do. And at this time in human history, with lots of folks who are wanderers, who, sure, we can say a lot. We might know more than a lot of people. We may be enjoying the illumination and the warmth of the sun rays that we find with teachers and teaching, and from within. But there is something, service to others is not a practice. This is a very funny point. The raw material community, LNL community, bring forth community, there is a certain evangelizing tendency. Just the term service, the very semantics of defining the positive path as service to other, I think is problematic. Because clearly it involves taking good care of yourself, going to the forest and meditating, the learning and growing portion, learning, growing, helping. The learning, growing is not a helping. Of course it is. So learning, growing, sitting alone, study, meditation is service to other, but it's alone. Well, then why even use this term, service to other? Why not service to all? Okay. But the you know, there's some problem there, I think. And this perspective, the guru path, or the path that gurus taught, particularly in Hinduism, you see it in some other traditions, but Buddhism is not particularly guru-related, except for Tibetan Buddhism, which is a whole other story, and it has some strengths and weaknesses. But the whole guru-bhakti way, the bhakti-pad, bhakti-mag, Bhakti Marg, the whole way of devotion and love of Guru, it's not problematic necessarily. But it very strongly encourages the disciple, the student, to keep to yourself and don't become distracted from your spiritual practice, just like Nityananda said to Captain Hatengi. Meanwhile, today, and those of us who love the raw material, and those people, I think, that have some sense that the raw material is the end-all and be-all, which I do not. Somebody criticized, some silly fellow long ago criticized me thinking that I'm pushing the raw material as the one and only truth. Hey, bro, how about my playlists? There are a lot of other stuff way far from that. I don't see a lot of raw material people bringing in half a dozen other traditions, actually. So, no, I think the raw material is beloved, and there are limitations. And one of them is suggested by the terminology that the positive path is called service to other. That seems to imply service is the path. Service is not the path. Transformation of the seven rays is the path. Transformation of the seven rays on the positive path, or as the path, requires green ray always, or just like Buddhist Satya, you know, the Bodhanga, Sapta Bodhanga, the seven factors of enlightenment always require mindfulness or sati. Likewise, the positive path always requires green ray, but it isn't doesn't require getting involved with other people. It really does not. And there are a lot of spiritually minded people who don't seem to know how to live without being needed by others, and don't seem to know what it means, don't become distracted from your spiritual practice. And then there are others who don't know how to be of service to others. So there are some people who seem to be attached to physical engagement in service with others, service to other, and don't seem to know what it means to drop that and not be and be in an environment where nobody cares about you, but you can be very well on the path of service to other. Some people don't know what that is, and then other people don't care about it at all and really don't have much ability to help others. So some people really can help others deeply, but don't know how to be alone. Don't know, can't be well alone. Can't be well continuing seven-ray development alone, meaning they are distracted from their inner work or spiritual practice and can't keep to themselves when they ought to. And then others who only keep to themselves and don't know how to be of service to other in physical, verbal forms of sharing. So Nityananda's making an important point here that people have their own process. And be careful you don't get stuck in thinking that you wanting to play the guru, you know? I mean, I don't think this way. I just do this because I like it. But when it's over, I'm not thinking about how can I help, how can I help, because it's enough. I have my own things to do alone, like that. And it's not like I'm some super yogi either. But people, this teaching to Captain Hatengi from Nityananda regarding that person and keeping to yourself is kind of important. So let's go on, and this is also even related to Captain Hatengi's experiences here closer to the end of Nityananda's incarnation. After 57, the master didn't make special arrangements for him. He felt like a virtual stranger to the new ashram's attendants, who didn't care about him, didn't know about him. They don't care. Nityananda did care, but was really in a different phase. And that's the sun ray. It doesn't care about you personally, actually. The sun ray shines upon all in its path. The sun is not sentimental. And we are sentimental. I would feel sad if I had hours and hours or days and weeks sitting with Nityananda in 1932 or 37, watching, you know, the darkness at night in Kanangad, and then losing it 30 years later or 20 years later, and a bunch of strange attendants and nobody, everything's a big procedure. So it's sad. But he's gone his own way. And that's something we ought to learn as well. Going on, so while Nityananda acknowledged that the old ashram only there is good, still let himself be swayed, or let himself respond to or direct his continued flow of life in relation to the throngs of people who kept coming to him for help. Going on, the second to last paragraph of the book, Captain Tengi wrote, "My last visit before he took Mahasamadhi was in October 1960, late in the evening, and after numerous hourly knocks on my part, an attendant opened the door and asked me to sit beside his chair," meaning Nityananda's chair. "The master was resting in his room. About 10 minutes passed while two devotees in the passage were trying to work a new tape recorder." I have to get this call. We'll pause here. Okay, continuing. So, Captain Atangi writes, his last visit before Nityananda took Mahasamadhi was in October 1960. And you can see how things have changed a lot since his prior intimate times with the master. "Late in the evening, after numerous hourly knocks on my part," trying to get into the inner sanctum, "the attendant opened the door, asked me to sit beside his chair. The master was resting in his room. About 10 minutes passed while two devotees in the passage were trying to work a new tape recorder. The particular words they had managed to catch were of Nityananda repeating, 'Without the Guru's grace, nothing happens.' Thinking of myself, I wondered whether my 5-hour wait was due to a lack of grace in my life. What, I fretted, had I done to merit such treatment? As this thought entered my mind, he emerged from his room to lay down again, this time facing me on the adjacent platform. The only light was above my head, and he looked directly at me as I nervously shifted my gaze. Nothing was said. 15 minutes later, he slowly rose and returned to the platform in his room. I was disturbed by the enormity of his body and wondered how he managed to breathe. My wonder was even greater because I knew how little he ate. When I informed the attendant of my intended early departure in the morning, he told me to meet him at the baths at 4 o'clock, meaning Nityananda had told Captain Atangi to meet him at the baths at 4 a.m. I entered the main hall to receive darshan at 6 a.m., I think, finding Nityananda asleep on the platform and turned toward the wall. I bent over to see his face. He opened his left eye and nodded to indicate that I could go. Again, no words were spoken. Even when my visits became infrequent, he had always said something to me. This was the first and only time that silence reigned. Perhaps he thought I had reached a higher level of understanding, but if so, I was certainly unaware of it. In truth, I left the master recognizing that a long struggle lay ahead of me. Nevertheless, today, as I remember the golden weekend spent in his divine presence, I am filled with inner peace and happiness. I am eternally grateful." And this ends the book entitled Nityananda in Divine Presence. And the, I think, note from the director of the webpage, "It is hoped that this small glimpse into the Master's life gives you as much hope, joy, and satisfaction as it has me. Maha Guru Bhakti," which means great guru love, devotion, or great devotion to the great guru, M. M is the one who runs this nonduality.com website. So, therein, or hereby concludes the book Nityananda in Divine Presence. And you can see how all things must pass, and Nityananda, it's first of all, it's Captain Hatengi was one of 10,000, 10,000s, many 10,000s of people who wanted Nityananda's time. And so to have 10,000, many 10,000s, tens of thousands of people wanting one's time, what a difficult way to live, I think. And yet that was the Danda Dharma that he offered to himself, Nityananda. And I don't know if at the end Nityananda was silent with Captain Hatengi because he considers that Captain Hatengi reached some higher level of understanding. Certainly he probably felt that words were not necessary. That doesn't mean Hatengi has some higher level. It just means words are not necessary. And I think it's particularly related to the fact that it's about to leave. He's about to leave. It's over. This is it. This is the last chapter, like we did today. And the last chapter of Nityananda's life, and the last meeting, and the last phase of meetings between Captain Hatengi and Nityananda, as Nityananda was full of the needs of the tens of thousands. His body was enormous without eating, because, just like that story before, it seems he had internalized the needs and the longing and the seeking, whether it's low or high, of the tens of thousands that came to him. So tens of thousands come to him with desires low, middle, and high, from lottery numbers to looking for a job or money, to please help my sick child, to please help me in my meditation, to please awaken me, to please guide me towards the path for my own transformation. Low, middle, high. And he had ate them all, in that he internalized or vibrated in harmony with those the countless desires of the tens of thousands that came to him. And I think he was tired. And words, it was beyond, the time for words had passed, certainly with Captain Hatengi, and really in general, the time for words had passed. And in fact, the whole Nityananda's whole life is not much of words, but of giving and detachment. I mean, his whole way was dana, or generosity. I mean, like a wish-fulfilling gem. I mean, that's all he did. That's all he did for decades, for tens of thousands of people, is to give them, I guess, just what they wanted. Not endlessly, but muchly. Tens of thousands were granted their wishes, low, middle, and high. And that he internalized that. He had given himself to it and become one with it, with the calling, the longing, the seeking, low, middle, and high, the desires of the throng, the mass, the mob that came to him. And becoming one with it, he ate it, or it filled his body. He didn't eat it, really. It just absorbed it, without, not by the mouth. And so he, his body expressed, was a manifestation of his mind, right? Where the mind had, his mind field, chittakash, encompassed the whole of the desires, low, middle, and high, of the tens of thousands of people who came to him over decades. And his body likewise reflected that chittakash encompassing, holding all, embracing the whole of all those people's, those devotees' desires. and the time for words was long past. And it's sad. It's poignant. Captain Ntenge remembering the golden weekends, meaning the beautiful time sitting with Nityananda just silently when there was no one around. Because when there are lots of people around, there's lots of disturbance because all those people are disturbed. I mean, go to an ashram, go to a sangha. Everybody's disturbed, more or less. The contrast between a teacher, a great teacher, in any tradition, and the throngs of devotees and disciples is very sharp, the contrast. That's why I couldn't sign up for any community, whether it was Buddhist or otherwise, because I don't want to be with those people. I'd never found some teacher who I would want to give myself to, nor did I enjoy the community. And that's just me. So everybody goes their own way. If you like the community, more power to you. And if you think some teacher is so great, more power to you. And if it works for you, that's great. But the precious moment in time, beautiful moments come and go, and precious times cannot be grasped and held. And nicha, you know, sabbe dhamma anicca, sabbe dhamma anicca. So all dhammas, all conceptualization, all thought and feeling, all formed experience is impermanent. Sabbe dhamma anicca. Impermanent, transitory, like a dewdrop or a bubble, said the Heart Sutra. And so that's the way it goes. And yet, it's really a beautiful story. And for someone who loves a guru, sitting quietly with their beloved teacher is the best. There's nothing better. And when you find somebody when you have such feeling, it's good to go with it. You may find that teacher's a scoundrel. Okay, well, you learn something. Otherwise, not. But you also may find that teacher has very little time for you and in the future, because they are available to all, not just you. And that's the way it goes. So there, this ends the book entitled Nityananda in Divine Presence. Now, next time, I will read, I'll try to basically complete the page Sky of the Heart, Jewels of Wisdom from Nityananda, also on the nonduality.com site. However, this is not the whole book. Long, long ago, in class one or so, I think, or two, I read through the introduction here. I believe the introduction was from Swami Chaitanyananda, or even the editor. And so the tone is quite different. But there are a few chapters on the page that are interesting, taking some of the material that was also compiled into Chittakosh Gita. Chittakosh is mind, space, song. Gita as a song, Bhagavad Gita, Gita. And Chitta, like manas, meaning mind or consciousness, Akash. Chit Akash, like Akashic field, Akashic record, space or field of mind. So mind space or heart space song. Mind heart space or awareness. A field of awareness. Awareness consciousness space song. Anyway, mind heart space consciousness song. Something like that. Chapters, Nature of the Absolute, from an Advaita Vedanta perspective. Nature of the Absolute, then Nature of the Individual, very interesting. Then Process of Liberation, and Conclusion. And I think I'd do that next time. So it is that was written by Swami Chaitanyananda. And then I will read directly from the book itself or read through the book from start to finish. because these are just certain portions of the book. And hopefully that'll work, because I'd rather not leave Nityananda yet. And I think it's very useful information. So that's it for today. And thank you for being here. I hope it was useful to you. Please take good care of yourselves and those nearby. Continue with what you know is good and true and beautiful. The good and the true and the beautiful. Stay with what you know is rightly valued. So, take good care. Good night.